You've said that this book came from wondering how Nixon let a botched break-in tear down his presidency, and that you did get your answer in the course of researching and writing your book. What was that answer?
Well, the answer is he wasn't as savvy as I thought he was. To my surprise, by pulling together all of his conversations about Watergate, a pattern emerges where he really makes decisions that are less than thought out. He shoots from the hip. He makes false statements. Then he wants to make those false statements become true, and they're not. And he just keeps compounding his problems. And that is not a savvy politician to me. So that's one of the revelations to me of pulling this all together.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Based on what you learned from the tapes and the transcripts, did President Nixon know about the Watergate break-in before it happened?
Amanda, I can find no evidence at all that Nixon had any advanced knowledge of the Watergate break-in. What's interesting is, had the men who undertook the Watergate break-in have actually completed the mission they were on that night, it was not to break in the Watergate and repair a broken bug and take some more photographs. It was really to go into Senator George McGovern's headquarters. That was his principal campaign opponent in 72. And had they not been arrested at the Watergate, they would have broken into the McGovern headquarters. Had that happened, I can literally trace from the Oval Office to Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, to another one of his aides, to Gordon Liddy, who organized the break-in, a pattern that Nixon gave the order. He wanted a plant. Now, it's not clear what he meant by plant. It could have been a person. It could have been a bug. Liddy would have certainly interpreted it as a bug, but I can trace it directly into the Oval Office had they not been arrested at the Watergate.
Wow. You close your preface with the sentence, "Fortunately for everyone, his," meaning Nixon's, "defense failed." You made the decision to cooperate with the prosecutors and investigators. At what point did you decide what was happening was no longer okay?
Well, right after it happened, I meet with Liddy. I'm instructed to go visit with Liddy to learn what has happened. And I come back from that meeting and I tell John Ehrlichman, who had been White House counsel, who no longer had the title, but he really never gave up the job. I tell him we need a criminal lawyer. He disagrees with me. He just brushes it aside. And so I will confront situations like this all the way along in Watergate. When I actually decide I've got to do something about it, Nixon starts calling on me about 8 months after the break-in, late February. I have about 8 meetings with him, and I'm not sure how much he knows, how much he doesn't know. I know today he knows much more than he let on to me. So on March 21st, I go into the president and tell him we've got to end it. And I tell him there's a cancer on his presidency. And if he doesn't deal with it, it's going to consume his presidency. And I go after point after point. It's totally extemporaneous. And I really thought at some point in that conversation he'd bring his palm down and smack it on the desk and say, this has got to end. He doesn't do that. And it's really, I think, the first time I meet Richard Nixon, the real Richard Nixon, because I'm deeply disappointed and distressed after an hour and 40-minute conversation. It's just the president and I for the first hour, with Bob Haldeman joining us in the second hour. And I'm very distressed, and I've also told him, I'm going to go to jail, Mr. President, for my role in this. And he just doesn't want to hear this stuff. I also hire a lawyer and tell him I'm going to do so, and tell him exactly what I'm doing. They start these rounds of meetings of how to deal with me. And their solution is not one that's acceptable to me, which is, well, let's make John the scapegoat of all this. Let's blame it all on him, which is just was a total fabrication. So it's at that point I do break rank.
And you later pleaded guilty to obstruction of justice.
I did. My lawyer, he said, you know, we're going to do it my way or not at all. Or I mean, you're going to have to find somebody else to represent you. Well, he's a very able lawyer. And so I'm willing to do it his way, and that is he wants to get me the option to have immunity. And he does get me immunity to testify in the Senate. But I told him that I really was doing it to end the cover-up and was perfectly willing to take responsibility for my own role. So I did plead, yes.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, you did take responsibility for your role. When you, before you started talking to the prosecutors, what had made you decide to help with the cover-up?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, you don't, you're a part of the team. I didn't see it as criminal activity. I don't think anybody did, with, I'm going to tell you, one exception. The one exception to that that I learned from listening to all these conversations is Richard Nixon. I don't think that Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Colson, all the other names that crossed the line and got involved in a conspiracy to cover up, really we were thinking about that. One of the mistakes we made is not hiring a lawyer very early who had criminal law experience. There was a lot of ignorance about the law. These are not bright-line crimes. You don't exactly see a blinking light when you cross the line. So everybody slides across the line. And I finally, after the election, when Howard Hunt calls and starts demanding money and saying he's going to talk if he isn't, that's when the light bulb clicks for me, and I say, this has got to be a quid pro quo. So it happened that easily.
Mm-hmm. I know you write that the infamous 18 and a half minutes of missing tape really isn't all that important in the grand scheme of things, but I still have to ask, since you do have an appendix in the book dedicated to your findings, what did you find?
Well, I did do an appendix because the media has always made this an important question, which I dispute. It's not in the grander thing scheme of things. It's not. People initially, when this gap of thought, well, this is probably Nixon and Haldeman, the part of the tape that's erased, talking about how they organized the Watergate break-in. Well, it's just baloney. And Nixon has a propensity to repeat time and time again important issues. And had that ever occurred, he would have repeated it somewhere in these 1,000 conversations. It's often been billed as 1,000 hours. I've never calculated the number of hours of conversations. The point is, the 18-and-a-half-minute gap that was erased is certainly not important.
What do you think we can learn from Watergate?
Oh, what can we learn from Watergate? Goodness, the lessons are endless. The Watergate reforms are long gone. What we can learn is, first of all, what happened. Other presidents can certainly learn conduct that is not acceptable. The book was written during Watergate of what not to do as president. In other words, you can't spend your time in that office using it as a tool to attack your enemies, which Nixon did. We can learn the nature of scandal, and scandal is highly prevalent. Post-Watergate, scandal has become the norm, whereas pre-Watergate, it really was the exception. And these are sticky problems. Disclosure is a key to dealing with scandal. Cover-ups don't work. There are a few exceptions, but they are rare. And they only compound the problem. We can learn that one of the few lasting lessons of Watergate are legal ethics. Had the code of ethics that now is in existence been present when I went in and told Nixon there was a cancer on his presidency, I would have had tremendous leverage. What a lawyer can do today is say, well, Mr. President, if you don't report this to Congress or deal with it, I have to, or I lose my license. That's a huge leverage, but that's in the model rules that the American Bar Association would write. So there are lots of lessons. The book is endless in that regard.